Accession number 4583, reel number 3.
Wing Commander Helm, reel 3. You mentioned the Arab Legion at the foot of the escarpment. Did you have anything to do with them?
No. They were all around the place, of course. The Legionnaires, they were a camel corps. But we had actually nothing to do with them.
What impression did you get of them?
Oh, they were a well-run force, very well-run force, which obviously would be because they were commanded by Glubb, who had a reputation in that part of the world for building up forces and really forces of law and order.
Can you describe what the setup of the aerodrome itself was?
Well, once again, it was a pre-war airfield. Most of the administration units and hangars were at one end of the airfield. There were runways. It was a runway airfield. But it was a difficult airfield to approach because there were rising hills all around the periphery of the airfield. So you had to be careful coming in, obviously. You didn't overshoot and go over the end of the runway.
Was there only one way to approach it, to land?
Well, the prevailing wind was mostly from the direction of the escarpment going into the airfield, so you were landing into wind. So you were coming in nearly always where you would, if you overshot, went over the top.
What type of accommodation did you have there?
Well, we had very good accommodation, really. The officers were accommodated in single rooms, but they had a sitting room at this unit. There was a sitting room, and leading off a sitting room was a bedroom. There was a fireplace where your batman could light a fire, which was necessary because it got extremely cold there. Don't forget, Amman is so many thousand feet above sea level. And it got very, very cold, certainly in the winter. And most of us had fires going all the time. The mess and library, a billiard room, was standard. All looked after by Jordanian servants. We had batmen who were Jordanians, mess servants were Jordanians. In fact, most again the menial labour was provided from the Jordanians.
How did they compare with the Egyptian workers?
They were better workers, I think.
In what way?
Well, I think they were more interested in their job, took pains about it, and, got on with it. We entertained Abdullah quite a lot in the mess, King Abdullah. He was reputed, we were warned the first time that he came to the mess, which was a dining in night, we were warned that although he didn't speak English or wouldn't speak English, he only spoke French, he understood every word that was said in English, and to be very careful of what was discussed or said in between the officers in the mess at night. And he was a very likeable, very able man.
In what way was he likeable?
Well, he was a friendly character. He got on with the officers extremely well, took an interest in what was going on the station, and generally fitted in, you know, with the environment.
Was he surrounded by a great retinue of servants?
No, the only time when I was present he came to the mess was he was accompanied by an advisor, a European advisor. I forget what nationality he was, but he was a man who spoke French fluently, and he was the interpreter for Abdullah, who, as I say, wouldn't speak English at all. But he ran the country extremely well. As I say, he took an interest in the service, he took an interest in what the RAF were doing out there. And of course he was passionately keen on Glad Pasha and his units.
How do you know that?
Well, he was Glad Pasha and Abdullah got on very well together. Glad Pasha had no problems in going to see him at any time, walking in on him. He really controlled all the internal security of Jordan. His forces did.
When Abdullah visited you, did he eat in the mess?
Yes. Oh, yes. It's full dining in night.
And he actually ate the same food that you ate, did he?
Well, we obviously had food that was prepared knowing what he liked. The food was prepared on that basis. Yes, I think he was a very pleasant personality.
Could the ordinary airman like yourself talk to him?
Oh, yes, he was sitting at a dining table with the station commander and the other officers. He would talk to anybody that spoke to him.
What type of things would he ask you about?
Well, it was mostly about the service life and what people were doing, where they'd come from, why they'd come. You know, the usual things that somebody like that would be interested in. Well, at least he appeared to be interested in.
Was it permitted to ask him questions, or...?
Well, to a certain extent, you could address a question to him, but not many of us did, for obvious reasons. We had very little in common with such a personality.
Can you describe what your duties were with 14 Squadron?
Well, I was actually one of the forerunners of photographic reconnaissance, because when I joined the squadron, I was in sea flight, and I was taught how to fly a Wellesley and progressed to a pilot in the flight. And then the powers that be decided that two pilots from each squadron would be earmarked when a raid took place to go out afterwards and photograph the evidence. So I was selected as one, and a sergeant pilot was selected as the other. And I always look upon it as being a forerunner of photographic reconnaissance, as it became known in this country. We didn't fly with the squadron during the morning. Once again, they adopted the Middle East working conditions. You actually work from 7 in the morning till 2, and then everything stopped. Well, we didn't fly in periods that the squadron flew. All our flying was done in the afternoon when everything else had closed down, because we went out on long-range photographic work.
Can you describe any particular incidents that you were involved in?
Yes, we're shooting up the beach at Haifa, which was one of my long-range photographic missions. Well, we were left, once again, very much to our own devices here. We were given not so much targets, but we were told to work out our own flight plans for a particular area and to go out in the aircraft, find the particular area, photograph it, and come back again. And we, of course, picked all sorts of places. Some of them were landing fields, little known, out in the desert. Some, as I say, were the beach at Haifa, where we shot up the local residents. There was very little control from that point of view. Yeah, we were left very much our own devices.
How did you shoot up the local inhabitants?
Well, by going at 0 feet right over the beach, which was well populated with the Jewish fraternity, all gaily disporting themselves in the sea and in the sand. And I got to Haifa and dived down right to 0 feet and went right along the beach at 0 feet.
This was just a prank, was it?
Just a prank, yes.
Were there any consequences for you?
No.
So you didn't get any complaints, coming? No.
Well, there wouldn't be in those days. The Jews were quite used to seeing RAF aircraft at any height at any time, because 6th Squadron were based at Ramleh at the time, and they had been operating against the Arabs. And I don't know how many DFCs they actually won before war even started, but their record was second to none. They'd done a lot of sterling work. And we were back up for them, actually. We were doing long-range reconnaissance work out into the Mediterranean, try and pick up the immigrant ships that were coming in to alert the Navy.
How could you tell whether a ship was an immigrant ship or not?
Well, you couldn't. And there was no way from the aircraft of letting anybody know anyway, because we didn't carry radio. There was no RT. So in actual fact, you couldn't report anything till you actually got back on the ground, unless you dropped a canister.
So did you just report any ship that was approaching?
Well, if there were any ships that you were given an area and told what to look for, you could tell an immigrant ship, mainly by its superstructure, the type of vessel it was, the number of people it got on board, and whether it should have been in the place that it was. We knew what ship should have been where. But if something turned up which wasn't expected, then of course people were alerted. But it wasn't our job to do anything more except alert the Navy, who went in to try and intercept it.
Alert the Navy based where?
Well, at Haifa. We're not Royal Navy contingents at Haifa of the fleet. And they were running patrols out to sea and all over the place trying to intercept these immigrant ships, if they could, before they got to the beach.
So if you saw what you considered to be an immigrant ship approaching Palestine, how would you...
Well, you'd have to either go back to Amman and land and report then on your debriefing, and then do it over the landline system, or drop a container with a message in it at Haifa, which wasn't a good thing to do because you never knew whether it was going to get through or not.
Why not?
Well, you didn't know whether a container was going to land and who was going to pick it up and whether they were going to take it to where it should have gone. So the best thing to have done was to go back to Amman, land and report your findings on debriefing and allow them to do it over the landline system.
How long would it take to get from the ship to Amman?
Well, it didn't take very long, say about 20 minutes from Amman to Haifa. And then you're out into the Mediterranean.
So what type of speeds were the Wellesleys doing?
Well, you couldn't do a speed over about 193. If you did, the wings folded up. Because don't forget, they were an 80-foot wingspan on the Wellesley. Although it was a single-engine aircraft, it was 80 feet a wing. And those wings were only held on by two bolts. And if you dived the aircraft at a speed of over 193, the bolt sheared and the wings folded up. In fact, it happened to a Wellesley 47 Squadron at an air display, where, in actual fact, he did dive the aircraft and the wings folded up on it. And this was filmed by a cinematograph film unit that was there at the time, and this is when the Air Ministry put a restriction on the use of the Wellesley. It's the only fault with it.
What type of height would you be flying at?
Well, really any height you like. I have done a meteorological climb in a Wellesley to 20,000 feet over port side without oxygen, taking met readings, temperature readings all the way up. But I must admit that I came down in a hurry because my teeth were all aching and I was short of oxygen. Wasn't a very pleasant flight at all. And that was after the outbreak of war.
How would you dress in the Middle East to go up?
Well, mostly we flew in shorts and bush jacket with a helmet and goggles. We didn't bother to put Mae Wests on or flying jackets or anything else. We wore our boots, of course, flying boots. but the temperature was fairly reasonably warm, and when you were flying you didn't really bother about the cold.
Was this even in winter?
Oh yes, because the Wellesley, you see, you could enclose the cockpit completely. You could pull a sliding roof forward so that when you were in flying it, you were actually enclosed in the cockpit. It was completely enclosed, and it was a heated aircraft. So from that point of view, it was pretty good.
Was the heating effective?
Oh, yes. Quite effective.
When you were doing the reconnaissance over the Mediterranean for these immigrant ships, at what height would you be flying then?
Well, sometimes it depended entirely on the weather conditions, what you could see, what you wanted to see. The higher you went, of course, the more sea you were observing. The lower you came, the less you were observing. But I think it depended entirely on the pilot, just how he felt, whether he wanted to go low flying or whether he wanted medium flying or high flying.
What was the nationality of these ships?
Oh, Jewish immigrant ships were chartered from all over the place. So some were Syrian, some were Lebanese, Greek. They were whatever ships they could get hold of.
So you weren't told to look for any particular nationality?
No, which you wouldn't have found them anyway. They came in under all nationalities.
Coming back to Amman, you described how the winters could be cold. Did you ever have any climatic problems as far as flying or landing was concerned with things like fog or snow?
No, we did have snow. There was snow very occasionally on the very high ground there, but certainly none that affected the airport. Fog, no, we didn't. You had none of the problems that a pilot would encounter flying in this country. In fact, it was ideal weather conditions for flying.
Whilst you were with 14 Squadron at Amman, and the Arab revolt was still going on in Palestine, did the squadron ever carry out any bombing missions against the Arabs?
Before I actually joined the squadron, 14 Squadron were, they operated in bombing an Arab force that had got holed up in a wadi being a valley, which was enclosed on all sides except the entrance by mountains. And this is where 6 Squadron came off rather badly, although they won so many DFCs. They used to fly into these wadis, machine gunning the hills. But of course, at that level, they were on really the same level as the Arabs who were in the hills. And they were firing at them at a sort of the same height. So they were flying through murderous crossfire, and many of them were shot down. 14 Squadron actually were sent out on one bombing mission where they overflew the wadi and dropped a couple of thousand pounds of bombs, which assisted in getting the Arabs out.
This was in support of 6th Squadron, was it?
Well, it was in support of the operations of the Palestine police and the army in Palestine. They got them bottled up in the wadi, but they couldn't get them out. So a couple of thousand-pound bombs dropped by 14 Squadron changed their mind. They came out fairly rapidly.
So the bombing mission was successful?
Successful, yes.
Would 6 Squadron pilots have had any alternative to this procedure of flying at the same level?
No. They had to attack the forces, and it was just a question of where they were. They had to go in and get them. So you had to fly below the height of the hills to go into the wadi. The main parties were in the ground, at ground level, you see. But pockets of resistance were up in the hills, and of course they were firing machine guns, etc., etc., at the aircraft from really the same level. So going through, that was the result.
Were there any bombing missions against the Arab rebels whilst you were with 14 Squadron?
No, they'd ceased, really. I joined 14 Squadron virtually not many months before war broke out and the Palestine Rebellion, although it was still going on, had also started to peter out because of the Second World War coming on.
So did you or any of your friends ever come under hostile ground fire when you were going out on these reconnaissance missions?
No, I must admit we didn't.
Or did you ever see any sign of any rebel activity on the ground?
No. No, not throughout all my service in Palestine. I was never involved in anything that constituted action of any description.
Did you ever hear of any instance of rebels attacking aerodromes during the rebellion?
Yes, they attacked Ramleh. Ramleh, of course, was a fighter squadron. Six squadron were based there, and they had machine gun posts all round the perimeter and up on the buildings near it. That was attacked on more than one occasion by ground forces from the Arab side.
With any success?
Well, damage, of course, a few casualties, but not really any significant success. They didn't blow up or damage any of the aircraft or anything like that.
During this whole period of your RAF service in 38-39, of course it was a period of increasing world tension as the war approached. Did that have any effect on your work or life?
Not really, because none of us in Amman, we were rather isolated, I must admit. None of us had an inkling of the world situation at all, and none of us really saw this coming. The first indication we got was on a Sunday morning when a signal was received from the Air Ministry in London saying put Plan X into force, international situation deteriorating rapidly. That was before war was actually declared. And
how long before?
About a week before. And I was transport officer of the squadron at the time, and I was told that the squadron was going to move to its war station. All officers were told to pack up their civilian kit and to crate it and leave it at the station to be put into store to come back to England when they could send it back. We were ready to take with us our flying gear and uniforms. The first line pilots flew the aircraft down to Ismailia, and I, being transport officer, was put in command of the ground forces going down by road. And we set off the day after on the Monday, and that was it. We were on the move then to Egypt, which was where our war station was, and then of course started the phony war.
Did you personally know what this Plan X was?
Nope, haven't got a clue. Only the station commander and commanding officer knew what Plan X was. We didn't know, except that it involved moving to a war station.
When you heard that war with Germany had broken out, what did you feel about our prospects against the Germans?
I thought it would all be over in a few weeks. I didn't see how the Germans were going to put up much of an initiative. I was always led to believe that our own Air Force was second to none. But of course, how wrong can you be? I might have known, looking at our own aircraft, no radio, no nothing really. We were very, very much behind everybody else in the Middle East. We were flying obsolete aircraft, but the war in Europe Well, we thought that would be over very quickly.
With by British victory?
Yeah.
At what stage did you realise that the German Air Force was a force to be reckoned with?
Not until I came back to this country, which was in 1941. Then I realised that the German Air Force was something to be reckoned with, certainly.
Was this during the Battle of Britain, was it?
Mm.
I think that during 1940 you had a rather interesting experience in Romania.
Well, yes, I was in actual fact taken off flying while I was with 14 Squadron because of an arm injury to this arm. It locked in position and I just couldn't move it. A couple of loose pieces of bone in the elbow.
How did that come about?
Well, I can only put it down to an accident that happened when I was a young man where I was playing leapfrog and leapt over somebody's back and they bent down and I landed on my hands on concrete like that. But nobody can tell me why it happened. All I know is that I was returning from a flight in a Wellesley and the arm locked and I just could not unlock it. And I made about 7 attempts to land and had to go round each time. But I eventually got it down and reported to the MO and they took x-rays of the arm and the loose pieces of bone could be seen and I was immediately grounded and put up for a medical board which took place in Jerusalem and they decided that it was too risky to do the operation in the Middle East, that I would have to return home to get the operation done back here. So I was off flying and pending returning home and I got orders to go to Port Said to connect with the Île-de-France, which was coming through, which was supposed to pick us up there and drop us off in Marseilles, and then we had to go across France to get back to this country. Well, I and a number of other officers and nursing sisters spent a very pleasant month at Port Said doing nothing but being looked after in an extremely good hotel. And the Île de France never did turn up. It was sunk, I believe. And that's the reason why it never came through the canal. So I was called down to HQME in Cairo and I was told that I'd been selected for special service work with the air attaché at Bucharest in Romania. I was told nothing else. I wasn't told what the job was or anything else.
What did you understand by special service work?
Well, cloak and dagger. And I was given a temporary courier's passport as I was going to take my uniform and revolver and everything else up in a diplomatic bag with me. And typical of the services at that time, I was also taking a wireless operator up with me, a sergeant, who was accompanying me with a pack set, radio set, in the sealed diplomatic crate. But they booked him second class and they booked me first class. And I left Cairo to go to Lydda, and they issued me with a false passport showing that I was an industrialist from the motor industry in this country, and they did the same for the sergeant pilot. And we got to Lydda and we were met by the Palestine police, who took me by car right across Palestine to the borders of Syria. Syria at this time, of course, was Free French. And
Vichy French.
Vichy French, yes. And they bunged me onto a train at Adana and told me that I would be met at Istanbul